The reading today is from James 4, verse 13, page 1215. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag. All such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you have failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you.
Good morning. Do keep that open and let me pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. And Lord, we hear again how challenging your word can be. Pray that that we will hear you speak individually to us this morning. Encourage us, build us up in our faith and send us out knowing you better and knowing how we can serve you more. Amen. Great. Thank you, Marcus, for reading so well. We've been studying James now for quite a number of weeks, and if you've been with us, then you'll have got used to being challenged. At least that's what I'd have thought. I've certainly been challenged reading it and then having to prepare it to preach, so that I'm not preaching as a hypocrite, but one who listens to the word before he speaks it to others. But I was having a conversation with someone who's in one of our home groups earlier on this week, and I asked this very thing. I said, you must be finding it quite challenging studying James in your home group week by week, and the reply was no. No? Oh, no, quite enjoying it, really. I was at a little bit of a loss. I think maybe I asked the wrong question or it wasn't very clear. But I don't think it's really possible to really engage with what James is saying here without being just a little bit challenged, a little bit perplexed about our life and about things we might want to change in it, a little bit rebuked maybe to live life a little bit more wholeheartedly for God. I don't think James is a part of the Bible you can just read and just let it float over you, if there's any part of the Bible that you can actually do that with. But there's a phrase in James that that came back to me in a new light this week. It's back in chapter 1 and verse 27, where James says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. And the learned who read and translate the Greek tell us that the emphasis of that word religion there, religion, true religion, what religion it is that God will accept and approve of, it's used here, as it's used, it means spirituality, a heart relationship that shapes the whole of life. The religion that James is talking about in his letter is a life that flows out of a relationship with God. It's a life of worship. What does a life of worship look like? Well, that is James's topic throughout the whole of this book. A life of worship looks like this. It's practical. It looks out for other people's needs. It's transforming. It results in a life shaped by something other than the world. From time to time, we take our cars down to the garage, don't we? And someone opens up the bonnet and pokes their nose inside and then whistles through their teeth. And we clench onto our wallets. And James's letter is a little bit like that. It's a checkup to see if everything is working fine. Is our life and faith as it should be? Or is there some maintenance to do? A little repair work. Are there signs of a life of worship? Is faith influencing life as it should do? Or is there actually a gap? I've managed to locate the picture that didn't appear last time I spoke, and I think that Christine can put us forward to it. There it is. There's a not much of a picture, I admit. And this is what I was trying to describe in words the other week. This poor chap here, he's got one foot in faith in God and one foot in the world. And the two are separating, and it's going to get difficult to keep both worlds intact. I wonder, is he willing to step out of that boat completely? Or will he stay stranded with that rather perplexed look on his face in that precarious position? James calls this double-mindedness. Thinking two things at once. Trying to live in two worlds at once. What James is doing in this letter is to force us to think through, is our life matching the way our faith says it should? Or are we trying to live in two different worlds? Well, with that in mind, let's look at this passage in front of us. Thanks, Christine. It diverges a little bit from the notes this time, but I hope that you'll still find them helpful during the week. I don't have a copy of them in front of me, but maybe you've got a copy in front of you, which might be helpful for you. I don't need one, am I right? Should be okay. We're looking at the end of James 4 and in James 5. James ended last time talking about pride. Chapter 4 and verse 6, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. And verse 10, humble yourself before the Lord and he will lift you up. And then he moves on to the whole subject of judging one another, saying you mustn't do it, you mustn't condemn or slander one another. And surely the heart of that is pride. And at this point, verse 13, he makes a strike, an incisive strike, at two other hindrances to our walk with God. And both are forms of pride. Both are equally relevant to us. Perhaps you noticed as we were reading it through, I don't think it's possible to read these words in James without feeling the directness of what he is saying. After all, we all live in a world that is relentless in its busyness. If we want to fix up an evening to see people, it means booking up weeks in advance. The greatest fear any of us has is losing our diary or our portable digital assistant. So James's words here about planning ahead are pretty relevant. But also we live in a world that's obsessed by money. So often people are judged on the basis of their income, the sort of home they live in, the car they drive. There are some people who make vast sums of money and there are others who have almost nothing. So when James talks about the dangers of wealth in the second half, this is pretty relevant to us too. So verses 13 to 17. Probably addressed to Christians, but who isn't concerned about tomorrow and what it holds? These verses are about how we make plans for our life. How we make plans for our life. We have a choice. We can make plans with God at the centre, that's one choice. Will God be at the centre as we plan our lives and live our lives out as we go about our daily work? Or will we leave God out of the picture? James lifts the bonnet of our lives and says, is God being honoured in our planning, in the decisions we make? Decisions about our time, our trade and our treasure, as the notes mention. Will we honour God in these? Or will we ignore God in these? Well, those three headings come out of verse 13. Brothers, now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, time, carry out our business, trade, and make treasure. So that's where those three things come from. And it's quite surprising. I'd imagine as James is travelling around the different churches in the area, he's probably quoting something here he's actually heard. Now listen, you who say, today we'll do this and that, and tomorrow. What's surprising is how up-to-date this is. It could have been said by any of us, couldn't it? In West Dean on Monday morning, walking down to the post office, making a mental list, walking to the station or sitting on the train or in the car on the way to work. Isn't this the way that we speak today? Today or tomorrow, I'll go here or there, I'll do this or that. I'll make plans for tomorrow, for my future. And who hasn't in the past mapped out some idea of how our future might pan out? This is what I'll do this year, and then I'll do that. And then I'll be able to have this particular career, and then I'll move up the house ladder, settle down. Then we'll be able to upgrade the car or the TV or the lawnmower. We'll build our extension. This is what I'm going to do when I retire. I'll set my goals for that. Well, James doesn't say throw away those file faxes. We'd be even more disorganized than we are already if we did that. Planning isn't the problem. But making these plans without honoring God, well, that's what leads into trouble. So he's saying, don't be presumptuous, boasting about your future. It's arrogant and foolish. And there are three things that we don't find it easy to admit. Ignorance is the first of these. Verse 14. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. Proverbs 27, verse 1. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. Money can buy lots of things, but it can't buy time. Nobody knows what time will hold for us, what tomorrow will bring. Who was able to foresee the storms in Cumbria? Who could have predicted 9/11? Who knows, tomorrow morning we may pick up the phone and in 10 seconds our whole world could be turned upside down by what we hear in that conversation. Maybe a birth in the family, maybe an accident, or a sudden fortune coming our way. You never know. We don't know what's going to happen. Therefore, in humility, we need to accept our own ignorance. We simply can't plan life as though it's the easiest thing in the world to do. That's the first thing. And the second thing, if we carry on in verse 14, is transience. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Or he's saying, what character is your life? How do you describe your life? As a building or a rock, something secure and strong? No, he says, it's like a puff of smoke or a mist. On my recent trip to see friends in Hungary, we got pretty active in the mornings. That was until my knee started to give in. And we had a run every morning before breakfast, quite a long run. And on the second day, we were greeted by this just wonderful mist over the cornfield with the sun coming up in the background. It was beautiful. But on the way back, 13 minutes later, completely gone, evaporated. James says our lives are like that. When the Bible uses a picture of our lives, it's often the picture that is chosen is a picture of impermanence, things that pass away quickly. Psalm 102, your life is like an evening shadow. Or Job describes life as the wind that blows. Or in Psalm 103, grass which has shriveled up and dried up in just a few days. Life is very transient, says James, and the scriptures generally. It's something we find hard to admit. We kind of feel that we have a right to a long life. Our mortality is something hard to come to terms with. The injuries and the niggles that I'm now starting to get, I'm not so sure that I'll shake off as I was in the past. Things are starting to break down. But even so, don't we? We trust in our health care these days so much that we don't really believe that we're transient or mortal. We think it can never happen to us. We believe our lives are more secure than they really are. but life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. What is your life? Says James. You're a mist, you're like a puff of wind, puff of smoke. And when we make plans for the future, if we somehow think we're immortal, we're in for a shock. We don't know what our lives hold for us. And the third thing that we find difficult to accept is in verse 15, our dependence. Instead, we ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. Deo volante. I learned it as a teenager, and sometimes you used to see it written on very devout Christians' letters when they wrote to each other. DV, if the Lord wills. It's the recognition that whatever we do, we can only do it with the cooperation of God. Our life is a gift of God. Our minds, our abilities are gifts from Him. And if we make plans, all the way through, we must accept that we're utterly dependent on God. Without Him, we can do nothing. I've never seen the musical Cabaret, but it's one that my father's been recommending that I should see as one of the classics. And for him to recommend a musical is something, because he's really an opera man. So I really ought to watch it if he's recommending it. But apparently there's a scene in it in which there are a number of, I think it's students, drinking, or they're at a party or something. And one of them starts, as happens in musicals, one of them starts singing. Tomorrow Belongs to Me is the song. And one by one, everybody joins in. Is that right? Katie's nodding her head. Everyone's singing that song, Tomorrow Belongs to Me, Tomorrow Belongs to Me. And many people think that we've got a divine right to tomorrow. Got it all mapped out. But of course, tomorrow doesn't belong to us. It belongs to God. And He simply entrusts it to us out of His goodness and mercy. James says we must recognize that. That everything we do, not just in a few important things in our lives, but in everything we do, we're dependent upon Him. We must lower our presumptions and raise our sights. We don't know the future. Our lives are transient. We're utterly dependent upon our God. Therefore, it's right to ask, how then can we plan in such a way that puts God at the center? How do we plan the use of our time and our work and our money? How do we do this with humility rather than with arrogance? How do we introduce if the Lord wills into our thinking and planning? I don't think James is encouraging us to be fearful about the future, but simply to be humbly dependent on the one in whom we live and move and have our being. He knows our lives are in God's hands. He knows that Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega, who has the beginning and the end. He knows that Jesus taught that the very hairs of our head are numbered. He cares that much for the details in our lives. When thinking about tomorrow, rather than being arrogant, however, we're to be humble and trusting. I wonder if you're like that. I guess some of the arrogance has been knocked out of our society by the current financial crisis. We now know that we can't always presume that our money will increase, or that our jobs are secure, or that our pensions will hold up. But maybe now instead we pretend that we're in control of other areas. We cling on to what we have all the more, rather than have our security in God. And James is saying, get a right perspective on your life and the time that you have. Your days are in God's hands, for you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. In contrast, verse 17, anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. He's been talking about what we don't know. We don't know what tomorrow will hold, but if you do know something, then you should be doing it. I think the gist of this verse is that if we plan tomorrow out of our own pride, we're going to end up not doing a whole lot of things that we might well have done, a lot of good things that we might well have done if we were more open to God. We don't know tomorrow, but if we know the right thing to do today, we should be doing it. Our sin is not just the evil we do, it's the good that we fail to do. I just want to bring this for a moment home to our life here as a church. Obviously, in our personal lives, we make plans and we hope for success. And we need to say, if this is the Lord's will, and pray that he will lead us as we make plans in our lives. And we need to do this in our church's life as well. We've been talking about a number of things that might be the direction for us in the next few years as a church. We've identified areas of our church that seem to be priorities to us. We've arranged task groups to think and to plan. We've invited the whole church to be involved in this in a number of different ways. If you were able to be with us at our vision night, you'll have had an insight into this. If you weren't able to be here, there's a report coming out in the December magazine. It might be the final magazine for a while, so you should get your souvenir copy next weekend when it comes out. We're, as a church, trying to make plans. We're going about our business, as James says. After all, Jesus said, "Go and make disciples of all nations." He said, "Go, and I will be with you to the end of the age." And there's a promise in that. Go and make plans, fulfill a great commission, and as you do this, I will be with you. What a great promise that is for us as individuals, but also us as a church. I will be with you as you go. It gives us confidence to make plans and directions and go for it. And yet there's the process of discerning the Lord's will and deciding how to go and where to go. I'm personally convinced that that this is the Lord's will, that the Ascension will be a people for will be a church for all the people of West Dean and with Dean and wider, a church for the old and for the young, for single and for families. And if they present themselves on our doorstep, for students and for internationals as well. We don't need to seek the Lord's will on this. Go and make disciples of all nations, he says. All peoples. Be the church. And we're seeking to be the church. But how we resource it, what priority we give to different opportunities, well, that's always going to be the challenge, particularly for a small church. Which is why we need to pray as a church. For the business of the church. We'll continue to plan, we'll continue to make decisions, we'll continue to strive to be a church that makes followers of Jesus Christ by helping people meet God. How? As the Lord wills, and as the Lord enables. Not that we might boast, but that we honour God. So please do join us in prayer for this. Come if you can to our monthly prayer gatherings. Please pray in your small groups. For the business of the church. And I'm looking into perhaps seeing if we could maybe even meet one morning of a week at the start of the day. Maybe whoever's free at that time of day can come and gather and just pray for the day ahead. Pray for those who are at work, pray for those at home, and pray for the church during the week. If we can, we'll come up with a time that suits a few people and make another priority to pray. I think this is part of the challenge to honour God with our time. And with our business. And also finally with our money. We're nearly out of time, but we're going to have a quick look at verses 1 to 6 of chapter 5 and just look at that final part about honouring God with our money as well. The same perspective can help us use our wealth wisely, not foolishly. Take a more in-depth look perhaps when you come back to it again this week ahead. Probably here, as James starts in chapter 5 verse 1, he's talking, looking at people outside the church. Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. It comes with the language and the force of an Old Testament prophet, as if he was Amos or Hosea, saying, now listen, you need to change your lives. Think about God's perspective. See wealth in a new light. And he says a few things. In verses 2 and 3, he says wealth doesn't last. You can't take it with you into the next life. Food rots, moths eat clothes. Gold, well, gold doesn't Rust, but even gold, will ultimately perish. You can't take it with you. Wealth doesn't last. Secondly, he argues that your misuse of wealth will be judged in verses 3 and 4. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. It's a very vivid way of saying you've stored up judgment for yourself. Why? Because you've hoarded your wealth in these last days. You fail to realize that you have to give an account, each one of us, for the way in which we've used what God has entrusted to us. And the wages you failed to pay the workmen are crying out to me, crying out to God, because you've exploited people who've worked for you, mowing your fields. The cries have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. So he's saying you can't take your wealth with you, and you will be judged by the way you use or misuse your wealth. Is there anything new under the sun? From Robert Maxwell to the boom and bust of the 80s to the present day, the greed of speculators and the money markets, the enormous profits people were making, the inside deals, and the people who suffer at the hands of those who are exploiters. The ones that suffer are always the small people, the pensioner, the small businesses. No wonder the New Testament says the love of money is the root of all evil. But the Christian outlook is different. How do we honour God with our treasure? That's James's question here. And that's a question that is actually relevant to all of us. How do we honour God with what he has given to us? James says you can't take it with you, and you will be judged by how you use it. So the implication to Christians is to use wealth wisely, not self-indulgently. And wealth means anything that we possess. If you have a home or a flat, don't just use it selfishly. How can it be used for the gospel's sake, to help other people? Perhaps introduce others to Jesus if you use your home for a Bible study or hospitality. It's an opportunity to share your faith. Jesus said something very similar in the strange parable of the unjust steward when he said, "Learn from the shrewdness of this man who used money to make friends. If only the children of light," says Jesus, "by being shrewd and wise, would use their possessions to make friends, so that in heaven there will be those who greet you and say, 'Thank you for using your home, your money, your treasure to bring the good news to me, that I might enjoy the glory of heaven with God.'" It's the return of Jesus and the truth that one day we will have to give an account for how we've used our lives and our wealth that should help us to not use it selfishly or foolishly, which only brings judgment on us, but wisely and for the good of others. And I think there we'll stop. James has been talking about worship. Religion that is pleasing to God honours God by serving others and keeping oneself from being polluted by the world. So how can we honour God? How can we honour God this week with our time, with our work, and with our treasure? Let's pray.